Off to Hollywood we go this week for my very special guest, John Ross Bowie. Note the sound of the last name. It's not Bowie, like I tried to call him. No, it's Bowie. But he stuck around, because he's a nice guy. And we talk all about his time on The Big Bang Theory, Speechless, the latest Jumanji movie. He's a writer. He wrote a book called No Job for a Man, which is all about him and his journey, which we talk about today. Plus, there's a writer strike in Hollywood, speaking of no jobs. So we're going to dive into what that might look like, the future for writers, AI, you name it. It's all there. It's a great chat with John Ross Bowie, not Bowie.
It's okay. It's a tough name because everyone thinks they know how it's pronounced. And it is pronounced several different ways. My family has always said Bowie. Whenever I do like a local news thing and I can see the teleprompter that the anchor person is using, it always says like BAO-IE, which is how I guess they that's the pronunciation guide that people use. You don't have to go back to fix it in post. We can talk about it right now. This leads me seamlessly to my Scottish heritage.
Well, I'm half Scottish Irish there, so we share a bit on that. I'm a Donnelly with an Anderson in there somewhere. So
there's a bit.
You currently hanging out. There's a big writer strike going on down in LA. We can dive into a few of things of that, but I appreciate you making the time today. I know it's a busy schedule, and you guys are getting pulled in a bunch of different directions right now as support towards the writers continues to grow. And so I appreciate the time to come on this little old show today from Vancouver, British Columbia.
It's funny, in some ways, yes, we're out there protesting, we're out there marching, but there also is a ton of downtime right now. So making time is not a huge ask. Also, I'm very fond of Vancouver and its people. Like most American actors, I've worked up there. And it's a lovely city.
What? How much time did you spend up here? And what did you actually work on up here?
Really just a very long weekend. But I worked on the TV show Psych, which took place in Santa Barbara, but shot in Vancouver, and made sense. You can make Vancouver look like Santa Barbara with relative ease. But it was, I was right by the... what is it called? Is it called the Gas Lamp District? No, that's San Diego. What's the...
Oh, Gastown.
Gastown. It was right by Gastown. I was staying right by Gastown. Wandered around. Phenomenal Asian food. Great bookstores. Nice people. I took a... My wife came up. We did a tandem bike ride through Stanley Park. Really no complaints. It was very nice.
There's so much being filmed. I'm in a suburb of Vancouver in a little place called Cloverdale, which is where the original Smallville was filmed.
Oh, wow.
They used it as like the premise. But now they film Superman and Lois here, and they've built a full set just down the street from us. So that whole CW team is up here constantly. But then James Gunn was up in this little town filming Peacemaker. We had John Cena up here. And then Jim Carrey was just here doing Sonic. At one point, I think last summer or the summer before, you had Superman and Lois, Cena filming James Gunn's Peacemaker. And then... Sonic all within two blocks, and it was in this little tiny town, and it's just that's Hollywood, I guess. That's movies and TV, but man, it was something. It was really the town was just absolutely buzzing, and that's not even downtown Vancouver, that's just out in the burbs. So
wow.
It's good. I know a lot of people love coming up here and filming and doing stuff. Okay, John. So the premise of the show, Do Did Will, the story of people. Why don't you tell the fine folks out there, what do you do?
I am an actor. I also write a bit. Most people would know me from a recurring role on The Big Bang Theory or a role on a TV show called Speechless. And then... I get recognized from other smaller one-off gigs here and there. Every once in a while, someone will be like, oh yeah, you were the yearbook photographer on Glee, or you were that lawyer on Heroes. So it's kind of exactly the career I wanted when I moved out here was to become not famous, but vaguely recognizable.
That's a good place to be.
It's not bad. It's not bad. It's a living.
You can get a coffee, you know, you can go to the grocery store. Whereas potentially, I guess, but you had you've had major characters in a lot of this stuff, the Big Bang, especially with the how massive that show got. I mean,
I can still, for the most part, you know, get my own groceries, as you said. You know, I'm not mobbed. Once in a great while, I mean, particularly not if I'm in Los Angeles, because it's LA, and you know, if you wait a second, somebody infinitely more famous is going to come into this grocery store. So, you know, there's no point in mobbing me. Every once in a while, I'll go out of town and I'll be in either a suburb of LA or a smaller town elsewhere, and people will want their photographs taken with me or stuff like that. But it's a nice mix of renown and privacy, I think. 'Cause I've got friends who are hugely famous who can't go anywhere, which is a drag, which is a real drag. And it's an extra drag if they've got kids.
Yeah.
And I don't envy that. But I have a nice little mix where I feel appreciated, but I can also go about my day.
It's got to be such an odd feeling to, because it's only, with all due respect to the thing, you hear actors directors and people talk about all the time. It's only movies and TV and film. Like, we're acting for a living. We're entertaining people. It's a craft. It's everything, but it must be so crazy to be that inundated with people all the time that want your attention for just being on TV or being in movies. It's
very strange. I was just kind of doing my own. I was just doing my job over here and trying to qualify for health insurance and feed my kids. And it's a little disorienting, but at the same time, I've never lost the part of me that is a massive fan of other people. So I get it. You know, if I'm, you know, I grew up in New York City, and you would see actors walk down the street, sometimes incredibly famous ones. And I remember that little thrill of, oh, I've seen that person on TV, or even less so, even people who are like, oh yeah, I vaguely recognize, there's an actor named Paul McCrane who was on ER, but when he was much younger, he was in the movie Fame. And he lived on my block in Hell's Kitchen. I remember seeing him walking down the street and just being like, oh my God, I watched him. I watched his 12-foot high head in the movie theater in Times Square. And now he's just walking down the street. And that is an intense, visceral thing. And then when you see someone from TV, it's even weirder because they've been in your living room as far as you're concerned. So you've got a presumed sense of intimacy with this person that is a little more, there's an accessibility to TV actors. And most of my work has been in television where you don't necessarily give them the movie star reference. You're just like, hey, I can look over my coffee table and there you are, man. What's up? And like, okay, I can't see out my end of that box, but hi.
Okay, so on that side of it, I often hear of actors that potentially get cursed with a role or something where they, you know, like the Seinfeld curse, you know, Julia went on to great things, and Jerry took forever. But, you know, Michael Richards, obviously outside of the controversy, never really caught on after Seinfeld. And Jason Alexander, who is a theater mostly, and did a handful of roles, tried a few things after Seinfeld, and it never really caught. And I wonder, as an actor, and you seem to do more character-driven work a little bit, so it places you around in movies and different things, I think, which probably helps you, yeah. But I wonder, but what is the psyche for you as an actor in that scenario where you're on such a massive show like Big Bang Theory? Are you afraid to get pigeonholed into that character? People want you to be him all the time, or do you have enough separation there?
Well, it's, I mean, it's interesting. It will definitely lead my my obituary. I was going to say resume, both. It'll lead both my resume and my obituary.
Yeah.
You know, my last 3 years on doing a couple episodes a season on Big Bang also coincided with me playing a very sympathetic, funny sitcom dad on the show Speechless. So that kind of took away, pictured here, that kind of took away a lot of my concerns regarding getting too typecast.
Yeah.
It's going to sound a little cynical when I say, oh, the only thing worse than being typecast is being not cast. And I do believe that to a certain extent. But at the same time, everybody wants to show their versatility. Everybody wants to try different things and show that they are more than just, you know, one physicist with a speech impediment. And I've been fortunate enough through just good luck and genuinely looking for different opportunities to do different kinds of roles. And Speechless was such a dream gig in that regard because I got to do a lot of the broad, silly stuff that Big Bang offered, while I also got to explore some much more emotional beats. That was just such a fun, interesting show and such a great character to play. So somewhere around 2016, my concerns about being too terribly typecast sort of evaporated.
Yeah.
And, you know, since then I played a sort of a creepy stand-up comic on a show called Feel Good. I got to play a really sensitive gay dad on Generation for HBO Max. I sound like I'm just rattling off credits here, but it's been interesting enough that, you know, I've gotten to go a great distance from Kripke, and I'm, you know, obviously over the moon grateful for Kripke and the people I got to meet doing that show.
Yeah.
The residual checks while they last, but it's nice to try other stuff. And I hear you about the Seinfeld stuff, and you know, it's interesting because, as you say, Jason Alexander, you know, that's a guy who was was so iconic in the role of George Costanza, but also has a massive theater background. But the other key difference is there is 20 years between the end of Seinfeld mm-hmm. and the end of Big Bang Theory. And in those 20 years, the broadcast television audience shrank with incredible velocity. So simply put, there are more people who saw Jason Alexander play George Costanza than saw me play Barry Kripke by any stretch. There's more people who saw Jason Alexander play George Costanza then saw Jim play Sheldon Cooper. I mean,
yeah, very interesting
and then,
point.
And then you go 20 years before that to something like MASH, you know, something like 60 million people watched the finale of MASH in 1983. You're lucky if you get those numbers for the Super Bowl now, because yeah. there's just so many more entertainment options mm-hmm. in your living room. Not to dive down on the economics of it, but the landscape has changed dramatically.
More options though too as well, which I want to mm-hmm. talk about with the part of the what do? You talked about a bit of writing. Obviously there's a writer's strike on right now, but there seems to be more ability for people to make content now and get noticed. The time, obviously you talked about it being a little bit maybe easier now since your role on Big Bang Theory, about getting roles and getting cast and maybe contacted more. I don't know if you still have to audition. I'm sure you'd probably have to audition for a few things, but
I do.
Is it easier now if there's no work to create work?
That's a really interesting question. The short answer is probably yes. To distinguish yourself in your self-created work is a little bit more of a challenge. And mm-hmm. I say this as one podcast host to another. Because of the, you know, the beautiful thing about the internet and the rise of digital recording is that everyone has access to it. The horrific thing about the internet and the rise of digital recording is that everyone has access to it.
Yeah.
So you are you're an increasingly small fish in an increasingly large pond. But yes, at the end of the day, I can write a small memoir. It can get published by a small house. I can use my own social media outreach to promote it. And that is something that's an opportunity I wouldn't have had, say, 25 sure. years ago. You know,
there's definitely more. I think once you get out there more time than ever, there's more opportunity now, I believe, for everyone to carve out their, at least their own little corner of what it is. And that's all professions. Like that's all professions. But with film and TV, with the competition being what it is, it's almost like upped everyone's game of individual content to see, you know, to keep up a little bit. And it's almost like there's like I have a couple of other actor friends that are like, well, I just keep posting stuff online and I get auditions out of it. And it's way easier than when I had to drive halfway across Hollywood and wait with 40 other people and then do 7 callbacks. And now it's just like they like you and your personality of what you've put up, or they don't, and they either contact you or they don't. So there's that side of it, which is interesting.
Yeah. I you know, it's funny. If you had told me 5 years ago I would miss auditioning in person, I'd have smacked you in the face. And yet there was the opportunity to really go in and not just audition in front of real people, but take adjustments and direction on the fly, which you can't do when you just send a tape into the ether.
Mm.
There was a sense of, I loved being able to hear a director say, okay, that's great. I want you to keep this in mind about this character and try it sort of from this angle. And that challenge of sort of reinventing your performance off the cuff like that was really exciting to me, and I miss that. And what I'm finding with the picket line right now is that I very much miss, there was a social aspect to auditioning, wherein, you know, it's very rare when you get to walk into a room and see 20 guys who are vaguely your type and who you have, and you, yes, we are all quote unquote competing, but after a certain age you stop sweating that and you're just like, oh, this is so nice. I get to see, I'm going to see Craig and I'm going to see PJ and I'm going to see Mark and I'm going to see Brian and all these guys, that are, we're all in the same pool and we're all trying to get work. And maybe this time will be my turn or perhaps it will be Craig's turn. Yeah. And, but it'll work out in the end. And, hey, it's only one page of scenes, so how about you hang out while I'm in there and we'll go grab coffee afterwards. There was a social aspect to auditioning that I am surprised at how much I miss it.
That's the one thing about the pod world right now, too, with everyone having pods, but also some people giving a little bit of insight into the world, which we never really got before. And I think that's happening with every single career. Really, the people that have pods in like security or people have in crypto or banking or whatever, we're getting a bit of a look into that space. Smartlist does it pretty well too, with those guys talking about going for different auditions and things that they had to go through. And I'm always, it always cracks me up when I hear Jason asking director questions. I'm like, I get, it's like me asking like, you know, somebody like yourself that's been on a bunch of massive shows and movies, or asking a hockey player, do you still need to be coached? Like, aren't you there? Aren't you there? But I guess you never stop learning.
That's the hope. That is definitely the hope. Yeah, the podcast thing has been interesting. And one of the reasons I started the podcast I do, Household Faces, is because, A, somebody said, hey, do you want to host a podcast? And I said, yes, but I don't want to just be any, you know, I don't want to just be John talks to his friends. So we very specifically honed it down to me speaking to character actors, journeyman actors who are maybe not famous, who are not household names, but are household faces, who you would recognize them immediately. and doing a deep dive on how you cope with the career's instabilities, how you hang on to your craft, and then just the kind of fun, you know, gossipy stories you can get from some of these guys who have been everywhere. You know, Kevin Pollak has worked with everyone, and he's a gifted mimic. So you're not just going to get a Jack Nicholson story. You're going to get a Jack Nicholson story with a very credible Jack Nicholson impression therein, which made it really, really fun to talk to the guy. But yeah, as to your comment about going deep into a profession, that was my intent with Household Faces. And I think we went deep enough that we failed to get, a big audience, because, you know, Stephen Root is an icon in my household, but Absolutely. You know, my in-laws don't know who he is necessarily, or they do, but they don't know his name. And so there was some, we're going to try it again. We're going to launch a Patreon soon. And
I would encourage
it.
I think that actors, especially that you're talking to, like what you're saying, I've learned a lot in this space. Obviously no one knows who I am. I've just been building this thing for a couple of years through various things, and it's built into a nice, great area for me now. Uh-huh. People like yourself giving me the time, so thank you. But I love those kind of shows, and I think that there's audiences for every single thing. And obviously we don't want to waste our time. It's like, well, I'm not getting paid from this, or I'm not doing that. Everyone's busy, so I get it. But I think the premise of your show is wonderful, and I think that the actors like that we look at as being character actors, like Kevin, I could listen to Kevin talk all day.
Yeah,
I mean, he's got such a great thing, and there's space for that. So hopefully you'll keep doing that. Maybe we'll dive into that on the Will side. But I do have a question for you about how did you do it? You mentioned New York. You're in LA now. So how did you do it, man?
Well, briefly, without giving away too much of my memoir, I had always harbored a deep-seated, hidden wish to be an actor and to go into the arts. But the catch about growing up in New York City is that you see the downside of a career in the arts, or not the downside, but you see how hard it can be. You know, if you're growing up in a small town and you want to be an actor, all you see are the finished products. You see the movies and the TV shows and the award shows, God help you. And that can give you kind of a skewed perspective of the profession. You don't see the people who have MFAs and are still waiting tables into their 40s. And no disrespect to that, but it's a hard business. It's a hard business in which to find consistent work. And so I got kind of scared off from a very young age and tried to do a bunch of other things at which I was not great. You know, I was a high school teacher briefly, but I was not terrible at that, but I was very young. I was 22 when I was teaching high school, and I looked like a senior in a tie. And I think the kids had a little trouble, as I would have, respecting that. So that didn't go very well. I tried to do sort of, you know, more mainstream office work, some secretarial work. I tried to be a copywriter for a while, and I couldn't quite get the hang of that. I had a bunch of different jobs in a bunch of different industries. I was in a band for a while, which is, you know, somehow even less reliable than a career in acting. And eventually it just got to a point where I was 27 and miserable and had tried all these careers. And my friend Andy Secunda suggested I try improv classes. And it was, and that's where it becomes just the cliched story of a guy gets up on stage, gets a laugh, and says, well, this is what I'm doing now. Yeah. This is what I do.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's every, you know, every third actor memoir has that scene. But I just felt like if I don't at least give this a shot, I'm going to be very mad at myself. It will always be something I regret. And after that, it's a series of strokes of luck. So yes, I have to quit my job and the relationship I was in at the time falls apart, but I can just move back in with my mom, who's right in the West 40s in Manhattan. So it's not a huge hassle to, like, it's not moving back home doesn't mean, you know, moving back to Buffalo or something. I'm still moving in, like, I'm moving back home in the entertainment capital of the United States.
We all move home. We all move home on the journey, man.
Yeah.
We all move home.
But that was kind of, and then the other great thing that was happening, this is like 1998, 1999, is that I was going out for commercials, this skinny, youngish looking 20 something with glasses at a time when that was the look, because it was the dot-com boom and the dot-coms all wanted nerds to be their spokesman. Hmm. And that was really, that was an interesting shift as well. So I had a bunch of, and I was starting at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, which was just starting to get clout, and casting directors were starting to show up, and it was sort of the new game in town. And I had a bunch of things working to my advantage. And then I met the woman who is now my wife in an improv class, and we moved out here to Los Angeles in 02. And I have been fortunate that I have just been making a living as an actor and a writer since then.
What was this phase when you made the move to LA? Was there a spot where you were like, I can do this now for the rest of my life?
Well, again, I got really fortunate really early. I moved here in January 02, and by March of 02, I had booked an NBC pilot, because at that point I was 30. But I was a new face, you know, the mm-hmm. LA casting directors didn't know who this 30-year-old was. And I got like the smallest role, the lowest spot on the call sheet of a legal sitcom that only aired 8 episodes, but it got me a big sizable foot in the door. And he's like, oh, he's been a series regular. You know, we can have him audition for other things. So there was most of my dues paying was done in New York, and mm-hmm. then it carried over. I was able to transfer the credits to Los Angeles.
New York or LA? Which one do you like better?
That's really complicated. I have a very, very complicated relationship with New York City. It is my home, and I will continue to root for the Mets. But it's also a very hard place to be middle class. Mm. It's also home to, you know, not to get too heavy, but a lot of my childhood trauma takes place, you know, there. I always say that, like, going back to New York is like walking through an old girlfriend. Like, not running into, walking through an old girlfriend. I'm like, oh, we had some good times, but oh, God, the fights were gnarly.
So would that be then, let me ask you this then about let's say you book a gig, right? And it's like, mm-hmm. hey, we're filming in New York for 6 months. Do you have to make that decision based on, obviously, family? You've got to balance all the rest of it. You got to decide what's worth it to you.
I would probably do it, you know, because it's being employed in New York is not a terrible place to be.
Sure.
And I also know how to live cheaply in New York.
Gotcha.
You know, I think there's a lot of people who would be like, oh, if I'm going to live in New York, I'm going to get a place in Soho. I'm like, you could. Or you could grab a place in Jackson Heights and live like a king.
Gotcha.
And
is that where all the actors are?
Lately, I'm told. Yeah, there's a big because they're moving deeper into Queens as the city gets more expensive. It used to be Astoria, which is right by the water, and you're 2 stops into Manhattan. But as Astoria gets more gentrified, everyone's kind of moving deeper in. You still want to be on the subway line, though.
Sure.
But so I feel like it hasn't come up. I've actually worked in London more than I've worked in New York, which is crazy. I would probably do it for the right job. But it would be an adjustment. It would be a weird, weird adjustment. There would be one part of it that would be like, oh, I'm going back into this part of my life that I left for a reason. And it's again a very complicated relationship, but there would also be a sense of hail the conquering hero, you know, local boy makes good to it. I don't know, hasn't come up. The fact of the matter is that Adam Goldberg got that role I auditioned for on The Equalizer, and it hasn't really been an issue since then. It hasn't come up, so I don't know what to tell you. Adam's great on the show, by the way; he's phenomenal.
Do you the balance now between family and? You talked about not you can still go get your groceries and things, so that definitely helps. What is that balance you try to do right now between acting? Like, I'm sure it's kind of I don't know if it's feast or famine for you now, but I'm sure it was then when you were still trying to break in. So, is there a balance of trying to get them to the all the things that they have to do? Be a available husband, but then you're also just trying to balance Hollywood and keep working.
It's a challenge, but it's a challenge that most working parents have to deal with. You know, I'm not gonna you know, what we have going for us here as Angelenos is a very deep bench of actors we know who could use the extra work. So if Jamie and I are both working, we can find somebody who can drive carpool for us, sure. or can take Walter to his karate class or what have you. So we've been very fortunate in the regard that we've got a really nice friend group out here and who are very much, you know, there's a myth that, you know, there's no sense of community in a big city, but you can make your own community. And we have a village here that we can use to help us strike a good work life balance.
Well, everyone's kind of going through the same thing.
Yeah,
I think, you know, in all walks, but from a character actor standpoint,
yeah.
Is that what you consider yourself?
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
So from a character actor standpoint, I mean, you're going to be right for many things, you're going to not be right for other things. You just kind of have to wade through it. In this did process, theater, maybe a bit of improv and TV and film. Do you like that balance, or is there one that you lean towards more than the others?
There's an old adage that actors toss around that film will make you famous. TV will make you rich. Theater will make you good. And I am trying to do more theater to get better, or to get gooder. And I am, and it's both a great time and a weird time to be trying to do more theater. It's the right now with the writer's strike going on, it's the only game in town, but, also with the writer's strike going on, you know, tons of actors want to do theater. Yeah. But I love it. I mean, I like being able to hone a performance in TV. I like being able to try different takes on things, but I also love the feeling of doing a play and getting a chunk of text just in your body and just being able to get out there and play and make it a little different every night without, you know, fucking up with your co-stars. I've done a lot of like small black box theater here in LA, and I find it incredibly satisfying, incredibly fun. It's not particularly lucrative. You can't make a living doing it necessarily, but it is a wonderful opportunity, and it sharpens me and it keeps me, it makes learning TV lines infinitely easier. You know, if you can get your head around a 2-hour Chekhov adaptation, you can absolutely learn the sides for your two scenes on Station 19. You know, so
I'm fascinated by any actor's ability to do that, which I like to keep them separate. I'm in the music industry. I don't go to a concert normal now. Like, I run concerts for a living. I don't go to a concert and, well, I try to just enjoy the act, but I'm generally like, okay, I wonder what that changeover is going to be. And oh, look what they got for a video wall. And I wonder, no, their load in must have been this time. Like my brain just goes to there. So I like to keep TV, film, and all that stuff separate because I don't want, I don't sure. want, I don't want to watch it and go, they used a 49 Rogers HC on that. I'm like, what the hell is that? I don't know. I'm just saying a Johnson rod.
But you find yourself, I bet, if you're at a really good concert, that's taken away, right? If you're really Absolutely. Lost in the music. Yeah. And so the same thing happens here. If I'm watching a good TV show, and there are quite a few good TV shows, then I'm able to just lose myself in it. And if the show is lacking somehow, that's when my head pops in with the, is that a green screen? Where are they? are they on location, or are they faking this one out? That's it. So is he even there for his over the shoulder coverage, or is that his body double? And that's when it's lesser TV shows, lesser movies that take me out of the process. But if I'm watching the Succession, I am all in.
All in. All in. All day.
As far as I'm concerned, even though ATN's inside is probably nowhere near ATN's outside, ATN is in the hub of it's like somewhere in the financial district, and that's where they work, and I'm all in believing it.
That's the magic of it, and that's what keeps us watching. Speaking of did, you did write a memoir that came out a little while ago. How much fun was that, and what brought you to decide to do that?
You saw the face I made when you said fun, right? Was it fun? It was. I thought for a while about writing something about my father, with whom I had a good but very complicated relationship. I'm using that word a lot. I realize that. But my dad, I think, also had a lot of artistic aspirations, and he was not able to fulfill them. And I think that was frustrating for him. And I wanted to write about that. And then kind of out of the blue, a literary agent named Todd Schuster saw some of my work, and I think saw my what at the time was a fairly robust Twitter feed, and said, oh, perhaps this guy has a book in him. And we met for coffee, and he sort of nudged me in the direction of the book No Job for a Man. The title comes from a phrase that my dad used about the acting industry way too much. Mm-hmm. He would attribute it to Spencer Tracy. He's going to remember what Spencer Tracy used to say about acting. It's no job for a man. I'd be like, thanks, Dad. That's this no job for a man paid off my student loans in a way that nothing else did. So, okay. But, so I feel like there's, I feel like it was good. It feels really wonderful to have written it. The writing process was hard. You know, it's hard to write about your parents. It's, honestly, it's hard to write about your shortcomings. And as hard as all that was, doing the audiobook in 4 days was exhausting. It was really, really, I did it in a little studio up in, Studio City, which is in the San Fernando Valley here. And it was, tiny little booth, director, engineer. And it's one thing to write your story over a period of 2 or 3 years. It's quite another to read it out loud over 4 days. And it was very intense. And I came home in a very weird mood every night. But it feels great to have done it. And it has been, of the things I have put out into the world, it has made a small splash, but a very positive splash. No one has spoken ill of it, even on the internet, which is striking. really, when you think about what the internet is, the fact that there has been minimal shit talking or no shit talking that I've seen, knock wood, is remarkable.
There's things that maybe warrant shit talking, but being vulnerable and talking about your journey and maybe some struggles that you had, especially that generation, who doesn't have a father or an uncle or somebody that's like, you can't do that job. Go call Carl. He's got a plumber job for you down the street. You know, one of my mentors, when you run concerts, people are like, but what do you do? And I get tired of trying to, I try to explain it as best I can. But one of my mentors is like, I just tell people I'm a plumber now because they just stop asking questions.
Amazing.
Because even with you, with acting, it's, oh, you're an actor. What have you been in? Well, then there's 20 minutes. We're doing it now. But there's 20 minutes of you having to tell your story. And then they go, but what does it mean? And then you're like, what? You know, it's almost like a mini podcast every day for you. So I feel for you on that side.
Here's a little trick I've done. And it's akin to your friend's plumber device. I worked in enough industries in New York before I became an actor that I have a sampling of jargon from a bunch of these different places.
Yeah.
So if somebody comes at me with, what do you do? Doesn't recognize me, wants to know what I do, I don't feel like talking, I'm a management consultant, predominantly change integration and Oracle implementation, and their eyes glaze the fuck over and they put their headphones in.
They walk away.
Wonderful. And it's like, oh, we're going to have a quiet flight then, are we? Good.
Amazing. Good for you. That's awesome. Okay, friend, we're going to wrap here in a minute because I know you're busy. So you wrote one book, you're acting all the time, but what will you do next?
You know, I'm not entirely sure, and I am at a place finally where I'm at peace with that. I am working on another book proposal. I have a draft into my literary agent waiting for notes. I am always writing things, plays or something. You know, I've always got a couple projects on the docket so that I can never cry writer's block. Like I'm never blocked on like all three things that I'm working on. I can find some creative energy for at least one of them. I'm really just enjoying being a dad. I'm going camping with my son this weekend.
Amazing.
That'll be fun. So yeah, there's a few, I have no idea what's going to be up in 6 months. I'd like to think the strike will likely be over in 6 months. And there will be some return to normalcy, but even normalcy is going to look a little different. We're still not 100% back from the pandemic. We are still, dealing with massive technological shifts in the industry. Some of which save time, some of which, cut costs in a draconian manner. Mm-hmm. So there's a few, there's a lot of different open roads ahead of me, and my personal journey right now is not letting myself get freaked out by that.
Well, I'm seeing a lot, especially when you're talking about Smartless, and Jason Bateman's sister, Justine, has been pretty heavy on anti-AI and what it might do to the business. So, and
she's a coder. She actually has background in coding, so incredible. She really knows of which she speaks. Yeah,
I know. It's such an interesting discussion.
Yeah,
because there's benefits to everything that come out and disadvantages to everything that come out. But AI seems to be, it's the topic of the week right now. And I know that I think the writers are definitely trying to put something into their contract to protect themselves from it.
What we're doing, one of the things we're doing, and this is going to affect the music industry too, is there is a movement to rebrand, to change the conversation, because AI is an umbrella term. Like,
yeah,
there's AI that can help us cure cancer. I'm not knocking that. What we're talking about is imitation software,
mm-hmm.
which can go after songwriting and can go after the first drafts of scripts.
Yeah.
And can even eventually go after the sort of deep fake technology that can, you know, keep me working after I die. I like the movie Star Wars Rogue One. I am very freaked out by the fact that dead Peter Cushing is in it. There's things going on right now that can really hurt the creatives, and it is this imitation software. So there's a small growing movement of us trying to bring that phrase into the zeitgeist so people really understand what we are fighting against.
I'm fascinated by it because the watching public, and I've already been told, don't know some of the AI they're already watching. And I think that's the freaky part, because it's technology is going to take us regardless. We can't avoid it. And I'm all for protecting everybody in every aspect and every profession from it. But I wonder about the patience of the future filmmaker or future film watcher of not caring about what they're watching. It's like, there's going to be an AI category at the Oscars now, or is there going to be an AI category, you know, or is it going to be all AI? And then there's going to be filmed without AI categories on Netflix. And it's so fascinating to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, there are still people doing, you know, quiet, thoughtful work, where AI has no place. And, there are, it's people. I've talked to some comedy writers who are like, well, I tried to make my ChatGPT write a comedy scene and it couldn't, so I think we're safe. And I was like, no, see, by entering the information you entered, it learned a little bit more.
Sure.
Stop doing that. Stop encouraging that. but yeah, I think that the key thing is making sure that real people have real jobs. That's always it, you know, that real, genuinely irreplaceable people are not replaced by machines, you know. And I'll be perfectly honest with you. If I've got a bunch of groceries, I don't go to the self-checkout for a couple of reasons. Something always goes wrong with the machine, and I would actually rather talk to an actual clerk.
Sure.
And you know, not do my own bagging. I am happy to help out with that. And so I certainly don't want the automatic checkout machine, you know, writing drafts of pilots.
Well, I have hope for it all. I think there's smart people all the way around that will do their best to protect your profession, especially and all, but,
and yours as well. And yours as well. It's breathing down the neck of music as well. And, but I also have, a bright core of optimism.
Well, hopefully you will continue the podcast and you will write another book here shortly. And you will keep entertaining us for a very, very long time. I appreciate the time today, especially given what's going on in the world and how you guys are getting pulled in a million directions. So thank you, John. It's really been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
That is Do Did Will, the Story of People podcast for another week. Check out John on all the socials and everywhere you see him. And check out his role here in Jumanji. I really was like, there he is. And I'm like, wow, did they ever do a good job of hiding you here? And you did a good job of acting and sending us on a loop.
My highest compliment I got paid on that set was Karen Gillan thought I was actually British.
Amazing.
That meant a great deal to me. Yeah.
That means you got the British thing right, because there's so many different, you know, dialects of it.
I just did standard BBC newscaster, what they call received pronunciation. Okay. I didn't try to give it a sort of like, you know, he's an evil sidekick from Manchester. I just kept it real basic, but she bought it, and that was very flattering.
Where can people find you online?
I am at John Ross Bowie on Instagram, and that's kind of it right now. I feel like I've aged out of the other platforms, and I find Instagram to be the least toxic of the socials right now. So
it's back to pictures, which is what it started doing anyway. So John Ross Bowie, thank you so much. Do Did Will, the Story of People podcast. We'll see you next week, Bill. Thanks.
What happens when we play outside? We become healthier, both mentally and physically. We become more creative and more focused. We connect with nature, each other, and ourselves. Let's Take This Outside, a new podcast hosted by me, Marianne Iveson, an aspiring outdoor athlete and nature lover. I speak to athletes, outdoor professionals, and scientists about their connection to nature, how it affects their performance and everyday life. Let's Take This Outside, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, and at letstakethisoutside.ca.
Hi. I'm Connie Thiessen, the host of Broadcast Dialogue, the podcast. We focus on Canada and the challenges facing Canadian radio and TV, as well as highlighting those moving the industry forward from podcasting and streaming to new broadcast tech. Check us out at broadcastdialogue.com or your favorite podcast app.